Parshas Naso, which is the longest parsha in the entire Torah, deals with the continuation of the theme of Parshas Bamidbar, which is the jobs of certain families of the tribes of Levi, particularly of Gershon and Merari. And then it deals with different aspects, what we would call the Kedushas HaMachaneh, the purification of the camp. So it tells us the different groups of people who may be impure on various levels, in which parts of the camp they would have to leave, whether it was the inability to go into the Machaneh Leviya, Shechina, or all of three camps together. The Torah then goes through the law, which we'll discuss, of an individual who stole money or withheld wages from somebody and not only deny the claim by not returning it, but swore falsely that they never owed the money. And the person has to make restitution of that which they owe, plus pay a surcharge. The Torah then continues with the very famous, very difficult law of the Isha Sota, the suspected adulteress, and the process that she would have to go through to prove her innocence. The law of the Nazir is the next law in the parsha, which is also an individual who takes it upon themselves an extra elevated aspect of holiness. They're prohibited to cut their hair, to enjoy wine and wine products, and to come in contact with the dead. Torah then continues with the Birkas Kohanim, the priestly blessings that we're familiar with, at least outside of Israel, on the three festivals. And the end of the parsha, which is really the bulk of the parsha, is the princess, the leader's offerings at the time of the consecration of the temple, and the dedication offerings of each one of the 12 princes, each one bringing the exact same korban each day of the consecration for 12 subsequent days. And although they brought the exact same korban, the Torah nevertheless repeats each korban, each sacrifice that each prince brought, because each one is found to be favorable in the eyes of God. So our first question that we need to deal with, it's a question often asked, is what is the overall theme of the parsha? Can we find some link that links the idea in the parsha, or some theme that's found within the parsha, which seems to be such disparate laws, different laws, albeit dealing with Kedusha Samachaneh, the holiness of the people, the suspected adulteress, the nazir, the gift of the princess, but nevertheless we'd like to try to find perhaps other themes that run through the parsha. That's question number one. Question number two is a much more specific question, and that is when we're speaking about how all the different princes brought different gifts on the different days, starting from Rosh Chodesh Nisan, so we know that the Torah tells us that on the seventh day the prince of the children of Ephraim brought the sacrifice, and that was Elishama ben Amihud. And the Medrash there notes that the Medrash says, Ephraim is the strength of my head. This refers to the prince of Ephraim, who brought his offering at the dedication of the altar on Shabbos. As the verse says, on the seventh day, the prince of the children of Ephraim. And we know that it was Shabbos, for we have earlier demonstrated that the princes start to bring offerings on Sunday. And the question is clear. We know that in general, a korban yachid, a sacrifice of the individual, would not be allowed to be brought on Shabbos, because we know that bringing a sacrifice entails a lot of desecration of Shabbos, the killing of the animal, the sprinkling of the blood, different aspects. So therefore, only a korban tzibur, we bring the korban tamid, the general korbanos of Shabbos, musafim, that were for the whole tzibur, for the whole congregation. That's docha Shabbos. That one is allowed to bring on Shabbos. And here we find the exception that the individual, Lishama ben Amihud from the tribe of Ephraim, he nonetheless brought a sacrifice on Shabbos. And how are we to understand him being permitted to do so? I think in order to gain a certain understanding of the parsha, I think the answer really is found in understanding the personality or the prototype of Ephraim and the prototype of his older brother, Menashe. And the Shem Shmuel notes that the real key of understanding how Ephraim was able to bring a sacrifice on Shabbos is to understand the difference between Ephraim and Menashe, both as individuals in terms of their name, but really as a prototype of two different types of people. And we know the Medrash tells us, and we know this, we've discussed this at length, that names are really the essence of a person. And that the last aspect of Ruach HaKodesh, the last aspect of divine inspiration, is found when a parent names a child. On a personal note, I saw this a couple of weeks ago come to fore in a very dramatic sense. It's in Detroit for the bris of my brother's child. And right as we got to Detroit, the bris was supposed to be on Sunday. It was on Sunday, and we got to Detroit on Thursday night. We found out the terrible news that our mother had passed away. So I know that one of the first reactions that my brother had was, does he name this child, whose bris would be in 2 or 3 days, does he name this child after my mother or not? My mother's name was Chana, so he was debating Chanan, Menachem. And part of his debate in his head was that since we were supposed to go to Israel as a whole family a couple of weeks from now, in order to expedite a passport for this little baby, he had already filled out the birth certificate at the hospital and gave the child an English name. And he really didn't want the child to have, you know, two names in English and then three names in Hebrew. He really wanted to keep it parallel. That was one consideration. And the other was that he felt that with God's help, they would be blessed with a little girl and be able to name the child the name properly. So he decided to stick with the name that he had chosen, and the bris took place bizmano at the right time, and the child's name is Uriel Meir, named after my sister-in-law's grandfather. And Uriel, for Lag BaOmer, for Shavuos, the light of God. It wasn't until a week after Shiva that my father noted that the Rosh Tevot, the acronym of this child, Uriel Meir, spells out Uriel is Aleph, Meir is Mem, and my brother's last name is Isaac, is Aleph, spells out Ima, mother. So that in a real sense, my brother named this boy after our Ima, after our mother, without even realizing it, by calling this child Uriel Meir. And this is what we mean, that there is this aspect that a name has tremendous potential, even if at face value, and it wasn't even, my brother wasn't even cognizant of this at the time that he gave this child the name. Getting back to our study, if we take a look at the name Ephraim and Menashe, we note the reason why they were given these names. So the Torah tells us in the book of Bereishit, in the 41st chapter, that Yosef named the firstborn Menashe, "For God has made me forget all my trouble and all my father's house." And he named the second Ephraim, "For God has made me fruitful, Ephrani Elohim, in the land of my oppression." And if you note very carefully, explains the Shem Shmuel, the name Menashe finds its root meaning in forgetting or distancing oneself from the past. This represents a particular sort of divine service in which one divests oneself of all manner of bad traits, hoping to achieve perfection in their stead. Ephraim, on the other hand, finds its root meaning in fruitfulness. This is a different style of progression towards spiritual goals, in which one focuses on developing good traits and performing mitzvot. And these two are clearly found in the verse in Psalms, "Asur merava say tov, depart from evil and do good." What's really at the fore here is, where should one place emphasis on life? Menashe represents the prototype of the Sur Meirah, move away from evil, get rid of the negative character traits. While Ephraim is clearly the prototype of focusing on the Aseh Tov, on the good, Hefrani Elohim, God allowed me to prosper, to multiply, to be fruitful. And this is really a key debate in life, and particularly in Avodas Hashem, in service of God. You take, for example, an individual who would like to go on a diet. So there are really two ways, or many ways, but two ways of going about approaching a diet. One way is to say, okay, I'll avoid all the food I shouldn't eat, white bread, cakes, cookies, ice cream, whatever it is. And the second way is to say, let me focus on eating good foods in my diet. You know, I'll have the pyramid, the fruits, the vegetables, the grains, and I'll really focus in on bringing into my diet all the positive aspects. And this too is a question of one's avodas Hashem. When it comes to different Kabbalahs, different aspects of acceptances in our lives to try to make us better people. So is our approach to say, well, I won't speak Lashon Hara for an hour, or I won't do X, Y, or Z? Or is the approach to say, let me take on doing A, B, or C? Let me take on spending more time davening. Let me take on sitting down when I'm going to say a bracha. Or stop to say Asher Yotzer after going to the bathroom. Focusing in on the positive. And this is really the debate, explains the Shem Shmuel, that Yosef and Yaakov had in giving precedence in blessing one child over the other. Where Yosef wanted Menashe, the older, to be blessed before Ephraim. And Yosef really represented a person whose whole life was spent struggling against bad to achieve greatness. And therefore he felt that the order of the verse, Sur Meirah Ve'asei Tov, put Menashe in front of Ephraim. That you first have to work on weeding out all the negative, and then you can put in and emphasize the positive. Yaakov Avinu, who blesses Ephraim before Menashe, is telling Yosef no. That in life, one has to really focus in on the positive. And it's by focusing in on the positive that what will happen is the negative will by its own right begin filtering out. The Shem Shmuel says that you really see the difference between these two approaches in the concept of Shabbos. If you take the approach of Yosef HaTzadik, the approach of Menashe taking precedence, so a person would say, Shabbos. Shabbos is such a holy day. Shabbos is such a holy day. I need time to prepare for Shabbos. I need time to prepare for Shabbos. I need to get ready for Shabbos. I need to be on the level for Shabbos. I really need to get into the mode of Shabbos. And a person will say this their entire lives, and I'll have a secret for you. They'll never be ready for Shabbos. There's no way they'll be able to be ready. The other approach is the approach of saying, you know what, I'll never be on the ready to be on the level of really accepting Shabbos. But you know what I can do? I can be on the level of at least trying to do certain things for Shabbos, have nice clothes for Shabbos, have nice food for Shabbos, and at least in some positive way make myself ready and prepared for Shabbos and accept Shabbos on the level that I'm at, but at least I'm bringing in some very positive levels of goodness. These two approaches, the approach of Ephraim, the Sur Meirah, the removing oneself from evil, and the approach of the approach of Menashe, removing oneself from evil, and the approach of Ephraim of doing good, I think we can suggest is perhaps one of those themes that links different aspects of our parsha together. And I'd like to try to show this in two different aspects of our relationship to God. One in the aspect of sin, and one, which would be the Menashe, the Sur Meirah, the negative approach, and one would be the positive approach of trying to come closer to God. And I think in each arena, we find the aspect of the Menashe and the aspect of the Ephraim. Let's explain. Clearly, in the approach to sin, it's very hard to have the Aseh Tov, the good, because the focus is really on the Sur Meirah, staying away from sin. But where you see these two approaches alluded to is in two different mitzvahs of the parsha that are back to back. One is the mitzvah, as we mentioned earlier, of a person who stole, withheld wages, or didn't repay a loan, and swore falsely and denied ever owing the money. So such a person has to give back that which they owe, plus a fee of restitution as well. So it's very interesting to note that in this section, the Torah tells us that part of the process of repayment is v'hitvadu et chatatam, they have to confess their sin. And here the Rambam Maimonides says, this is the source of the positive mitzvah to do tshuva, not only in this case, but we learn tshuva, that we have to confess as part of the repentance process, we learn it for the entire, all the mitzvahs in the Torah. It's specifically from this mitzvah that we learn about all mitzvahs in the Torah that you have to have this part of the Hitzvadu to confess. So Rav Sternbach in Tam Vadas asks the obvious question. Why is it that it's this specific law of stealing, of the refusal to pay back, that we learn the mitzvah of tshuva, the mitzvah of vidui, of confession. Why wasn't another mitzvah in the Torah chosen? So Rav Sternbach explains so beautifully. He says, what's unique about this mitzvah is that when you return the object that you stole or the money that you owe, so now you're completely rid of any guilt. You've taken away, as he says, umochach shirachas b'nikayon kapav. He's washed himself completely of the sin, and now he's able to go onward in life. The sin of the story of the stealing becomes a model for us of the menashe of the sur meira. The way to really do tshuva is to remove yourself completely from the sin. And that we know is the real tshuva. The aziva sachet is one very crucial component. To remove yourself from the sin completely. The law having to do with returning an object is such a beautiful paradigm, such a perfect paradigm of the menashe aspect of the sur meira, the stay away from evil. The way to remove yourself from sin is to completely give back that which you have taken, and now there is no trace of sin, and that then becomes a model of all mitzvos in the Torah, that the way you're going to have restitution, the way you're going to have forgiveness, is that you have repaid completely. You have separated yourself completely from the object of sin. That's the model, Menashe, of the sur meira, of the removal from evil. But this is another aspect of what sin is about, of what restitution is about, what vidui, what confession is about. And that perhaps is suggested in the law of the Isha Sota, the law of the suspected adulteress. We know that this law, believe it or not, is really for the benefit of the woman. The husband suspects a woman of perhaps being alone with somebody, warns her not to be, and there are two witnesses that say that they saw her alone with this individual she was warned not to be alone with. We need to understand that clearly a man is allowed to be married to more than one wife, which a woman is not allowed to be. And here, the woman is given the opportunity to really show her innocence and be allowed to be once again, to be back with her husband. And she goes through this process of the Isha Sota, of drinking the waters. And if she is found innocent, so then the Torah says she's allowed to be back with her husband, and they are blessed with the ability to conceive a child, which is understood on many different levels. If she had difficulty having children, she'll have an easier time. If she only had girls, she'd be blessed with a son as well. Some even say if she never even had children, she'll be blessed with children. And this is a very fascinating law of the restitution of the husband and wife back together again after his suspicion. It's very interesting, Lubavitcher Rebbe in the Torah Studies notes that there's a statement in the Talmud that a person does not commit a transgression unless the spirit of folly enters in him. The concept of doing an aveira, a sin, means that you got this crazy knack that comes into your head, because no one in their right mind would really sin. And the text that's used as a support that this is indeed what happens is a text from our selection of the Isha Sota, if any man's wife goes aside. So the question Lubavitcher Rebbe asked is, what is the connection between them? Why is adultery, of all the many transgressions, the one that most conclusively shows that sin is always irrational? And here Lubavitcher Rebbe understands the sin, or the suspicion of the husband and wife of the Isha Sota, in allegorical terms, that's really a model for an individual's sin and relationship with God. And he notes a number of connections between this story, this law, and our relationship with God. He first notes, which we'll do very briefly, is that the Jewish people and God have an eternal and mutual loyalty, a marriage in which God is the male, the initiating partner, and we, the females, the keepers of the faith, even exiles, not a separation, a divorce. And that is why the statement of the folly of sin, every sin is followed by the phrase from our Sedra, less as a proof than an explanation. How is it that even a trivial sin is folly? Because it brings about a severing of the link between man and God. Why does it do so? Because an act of infidelity intervening in the marriage between God and the Jew. So the relationship between this husband and wife is really a model of our relationship with God. That although we go astray, we have the ability to have restitution, we have the ability to come back. And that's how he explains. Continuing in the writings of the Rebbe, he says, the stigma is short-lived. If after the procedure for deciding whether suspicion was well-founded, she is deemed innocent, she returns to her husband untainted, she shall be cleared, and she shall conceive seed. And this too is the case with a Jew who in a spirit of folly commits a sin. The breach he opens up between himself and God is only a temporary one. And in the last analysis, my glory, that is a godly spark within every Jew, I will not give to another. No Jew is ever so distant from God that he cannot return untainted and pure. And this continues the Rebbe as a second connection. Just as a wife suspected by her husband is only temporarily displaced from a marital closeness, so is the separation from God, which a sin creates, only a passing moment. Anytime we sin against God, we're really sinning against that relationship that we have with God. That relationship of husband and wife, that relationship of closeness. The model the Isha Sota is, back to her husband and be able to rebuild and reconnect that relationship. And here comes the key. The key is that a person should never say, well, I've fallen away from the trust of my husband, or I've fallen away from the trust of God, and therefore there's nothing I can do about it, it's too late. The answer is no. The model, the Isha Sota, is such an important model for our lives, is we do disappoint people, and we disappoint people very close to us. But we know that there's always the ability to forgive. And the model of God allowing his name to be erased in order to bring back the peace between husband and wife is the model where God is willing to accept us even when we are separated from him and be able to reunite with him. And as Lubavitcher Rebbe continues, he says, this hope lies before the person who has sinned. He must not fall prey to melancholy or despair, for God has said, my glory I will give to another. And when he returns to God, he too will be fruitful. He will rise to love and fear of God. He will work towards true closeness until husband and wife are united and the presence of the divine is revealed in his soul. This is his personal redemption, where an individual has the ability to sin against God, and not only has to go through the Menashe, the removing himself of the sin, but there's an aspect as well of the Ephraim, the aspect of the woman coming back to her husband and conceiving a child, the aspect of Hifania, being fruitful, the aspect that when we come back to God, it's not just enough to reinstate the relationship, we have to allow the relationship to be even deeper. That any time we come back to somebody and we work hard enough because it's important to us to reconnect with that person, so then the closeness that is developed as a result is a much higher and deeper closeness than was felt previously. And this is the aspect, the Isha Sota on a level of allegory, is the aspect of Ephraim in our parsha, where we are distant from God perhaps for sin, for having the spirit of folly enter into us, but we have the ability to come back to God as this woman comes back to her husband and really develop and enhance our relationship with God, the Hifrani, that we focus in on how our relationship is going to be closer, how our bond is going to be that more special between ourselves and God. The second aspect is the aspect of coming closer to God. With respect, we see the two models of Ephraim and Menashe. The model of Menashe, of the removing from the negative, is clearly the next aspect of the parasha, the aspect of Nazir. The Nazir, as we know, is an individual who says that the way I want to get closer to God, to become a master over himself, is by abstaining from that which is permissible but unnecessary. He doesn't drink wine, he doesn't come in contact with the dead, he doesn't cut his hair. All of these are aspects where he says that I need to separate from aspects of this world in order to come closer to God. This is the aspect of Menashe. This is the aspect of Sur Meira, remove oneself from those items that one feels may be hindrances in your relationship with God, may be hindrances in terms of being overindulging in the pleasures of this world and preventing you from relationship with God. The Nazir then becomes the model of the individual who separates himself from the worldly pleasures in order to have an elevated relationship with God. That's what the Siva Shalom Islam and the Rebbe points out so clearly. He says, well, if a person is faced with which path they should choose in their Avodas Hashem, their service of God, Im Lehi Na'er, is it to Lifrosh Legamrei Micholin Yanei Olam Hazeh, to throw off completely all the pleasures of this world, or Sheyasok Bin Yanei Hanaot Olam Hazeh Vayigbein Lashem Yitbarach, or to be involved in the pleasures of this world and elevate them to God. Clearly, he says, Sheyudi Yasok Bechol HaYanim HaKashmiim V'Yarim HaTakol Hashem Hashem. Clearly, the model is to take the pleasures of this world and elevate them to God. And that is why one approach, why another is called the Chota Sinner. Because the model is not separation. The model is the ability to embrace this world. And we know our rabbis teach us that we are held accountable for all the pleasures of this world that we don't utilize. You live a couple of hours from the Grand Canyon, how come you never visited it? How come you never saw the glories of God? This is what we are held accountable with in life, to be able to utilize God's pleasure. And that's why, explains in the Siva Shalom, there's a continuum in the Parsha, where the Parsha of the Nazir is the person who separates himself. The Birkos Kohanim, the next aspect, is really the synthesis, where Yivarecha Hashem Vishvarecha, that God should bless you with property and watch that property. There is this aspect of the physical aspects of this world. And perhaps the model, as we'll soon see in a moment, of individuals who are able to elevate the physical in this world is the finale of the Parsha, the Nesi'im, where they bring different items to the tabernacle and utilize them as sacrifices, and the gold and the silver, and be able to bring them up as gifts to God. The Nazir therefore represents for us the Sur Meira, the Menashe, removing oneself from the difficulties of this world in order to come close to God. The end of the Parsha, the Nesi'im, it's a model of the Ephraim, of the Aseh Tov, of focusing in on the positive, taking the physical aspects of this world and elevating them to God. I would like, as our final point for this afternoon, to understand perhaps a little bit more deeply what the model of Ephraim is really about. The model of doing good, the model of focusing in on the positive. And I think it goes beyond just doing good acts. It goes into a state of being proactive rather than reactive. And I think if we understand a little bit more deeply what is the aspect, the background behind the Nesi'im, the princes bringing these gifts, bringing these sacrifices at the time of the consecration of the tabernacle, we can have a better insight into really what the model of Ephraim is for our lives. I'd like to briefly go through this model in the writings of Rabbi Miller in Shabbat Shirim. He says, what was the reason behind the princes bringing these sacrifices, these gifts at this time? So he said that we've met these princes before. We met them at the time when donations were being asked to be given to the tabernacle. And the Nesi'im, the princes, were the ones that said, you know, let's wait till everyone donates that which they donate, and whatever is missing, we'll fill in the rest. And what happened was, what was missing was the stones for the breastplate for the high priest, and that's what they donated. So ask Ray Miller, but what was wrong with what the Nesi'im did? They were criticized for that. And because they were criticized for that, for waiting, here they're taking the initiative, here they're donating even before they're asked. So ask Rabbi Miller, was this not better than donating things that others might also donate? You know, you have this, for example, with a baby shower. So you could say, you know, let everyone give gifts to the parent, and then whatever is missing, so that whatever they need, so then I'll fill in, I'll give. Does this make more sense than getting, you know, three of the same things? What was wrong with the psychology of the Nesi'im? That in this case of the consecration, they now had to take, and they felt they needed to take the initiative. Rav Miller says you can find a parallel story in the personality of David HaMelech. We know that David HaMelech turns to Natan the prophet and he says, verse says, and the king said to the prophet Natan, see now I am dwelling in a house of cedars, and the ark of God dwells within a curtain, I'd like to build a temple. And God decided, no, you are a man of blood, as Divrei Yamim tells us, Shlomo is a man of peace, your son will build a temple. But the Medrash here says a very fascinating thing. The Medrash said, it is not you who will build, because you gave precedence to your honor over my honor. For it was only when you saw yourself dwelling in a house of cedars that you demanded. What was the difference between David and Shlomo? David built his own house, and after he saw his own beautiful house, he said, you know, it would be a great idea for God to have a house. Shlomo Melech said, no. Let me first build a house for myself, for God, and then let me build a house for myself. The difference is a difference of initiation. The difference is a difference of spontaneity. The difference is a difference of really desiring to give. The difference is a difference of initiative. And this is so key in our relationship with God and in life. And that's how the Maharal explains a very famous statement that there are three cases in the Torah that the word if is used, but really means when. It's not, well, if you want to do it, then do it, but rather when you're going to do it. Im is really key. But it's written in an ambiguous sense as if you would want to do it. The three cases are the building of an altar, lending money to the poor, and the first fruits of the annual barley crops, the Minchas Bikurim. So ask the Maharal, well, why are all three written in such ambiguous terms that this is what you have to do? You have to lend money. So why does it say, well, if you will lend money? He says, because in all three cases, commandments though they are, fulfillment depends on the performance in a voluntary spirit as if they stem from man's own initiative. In life, you have to want to build an altar to God. You have to want to lend money to the poor. You have to want to show this thankfulness to God in the Minchas Bikurim. Life is not only about being told what to do. Life is about you wanting to do it. Life is about being proactive. By utilizing this ambiguous term, the Torah is telling us that when you're going to do it, because you're going to have to do it as if it were an if. As if you yourself said, this is what I want to do. Because what Torah really demands from us, and this is not only in these three cases, it's what life is about, is that when you do these acts, do it because this is what you want to do, and the best way of doing it is do it in a proactive way, not in a reactive way. And that is why the Maharal explains that the Talmud tells us that Gemilus Chesed, acts of kindness, is far greater than tzedakah, than charity. And it gives different reasons why. Because charity is done with money, kindness can be done with money or with other aspects. Charity is for the poor, well, kindness can be for the rich or the poor. And charity is for the living, well, acts of kindness is for the living and those no longer alive. But they go one step further, explains the Maharal. Charity originates in the need of the recipient, which is relieved by giving the charity. If there were no poor, there'd be no charity. But kindness stems from the bestower, from the innate goodness of human nature that seeks an outlet in acts of kindness. It is spontaneous, not the result of external pressures. What Gemilus Chesed is about, what kindness is about, what kindness serves as a model of life is about, is the desire to do good. The Ephraim, the Hephrani that God allowed me to multiply, the initiative of the Nesiim is let me go out and see how I can give. Let me go out and feel how I can fill a need. This, as Rav Moshe explains in Drash Moshe, is the paradigm of Avraham Avinu, who's sitting at his tent, kichol mayom, in the heat of the day, and he's really upset that there are no guests. So, the Medrash tells us God felt bad for him, so he sent three angels as guests. So, as Rav Moshe, well, hold on a second. What does it mean that Avraham felt bad that there was no guest? If there are no guests, there's no guest. I can understand that if there was guests and he wasn't able to help them as much as he wanted, he'd feel bad. But he says, like, wanting guests and there are no guests is like wishing that today, which is Wednesday, you would wish it was Shabbos. It's not Shabbos. There are no guests. Why should you feel bad? But says Rav Moshe, you're missing the point. Because de'ika mitzvah miyuchedet she'adam yit'aveh la'asot chesed. The aspect of chesed is that a person should want it and desire to do chesed. It's like you're chalishing to eat a chocolate bar. It's that desire, and you're not going to be satiated until you eat that chocolate bar. Avraham Avinu felt that he wasn't going to be a full person unless he was able to do that act of chesed. Even if there was no opportunity right now, he sat looking for people in pain on the third day of the Bris Milah, anticipating, wanting to do this act of chesed. This is the aspect, says Rav Moshe, the ahava, out of love, even when there is no obligation to do, because you love to do, you love to give, you're going to search out ways for doing. That's the model of Ephraim. The model of Ephraim, of doing positive acts, is not just doing positive acts, it's being proactive. Perhaps to give two personal examples where I saw this recently really come to the fore. Going back to the earlier story I mentioned of sitting Shiva in Detroit, so I had a number of phone calls from people from Los Angeles calling up to be Menachem Avel, and I basically had two groups of phone calls. One, people, very giving and good-hearted people, said, Shira, whatever we can do, let us know, and we'll help you out. And then there was an individual, really a number of individuals, one in particular, who said to me, Shira, who has the key to your house? That individual went to my neighbor who has a key to our house, set up the entire house, covered the mirrors, put food in the refrigerator, brought over her own folding chairs from her house, brought over a candle, whatever it was, and set up the entire house so that when I would come back in the middle of Shiva, I would have a house ready to sit Shiva in. This is what we're talking about, being proactive. This individual set up the meals so that lunch and dinner every single day, we had meals at our house. This is what we're talking about, of the Ephraim, of going out and doing. The second example is a very, very touching example. I gave a final this past week to my ninth graders at Jula, and all of them came as a group to Menachem Avil, 25, 26 of them, Kedai Nahara. And one of them, as part of the final, wrote me a letter. And she wrote me how terrible she felt about the fact that I lost my mother. And she said she didn't know what to do for me. So she just recently got Esther Jungreis's book, The Committed Life, and she read the selection on grief and on mourning. I read the story that we had mentioned a number of months ago of the rabbi who paid a shiva visit to the family, Lo Aleinu, who lost their only child. And the way the rabbi was able to comfort them was by sitting and crying with them. So I noted, and as this girl also pointed out, that she was the only one who sat and cried among all the girls that came over and visited. And the girl wrote me and said, I didn't know what to do, Mrs. Smiles, in order to really show you how I felt. So I felt that if I would sit and cry with you, so then that would be my way of extending my feelings and sympathy to you. And I said, incredible sensitivity of a 14-year-old girl. Again, the feeling of not thinking, well, what shouldn't I say in a house of Shiva? The Menashe, the Sur Meirah, but rather the Ephraim, the proactive. Well, what can I do as a 14-year-old girl in order to some way connect and have my teacher feel the way I feel by sitting and crying? What a model for life. The model of going out and seeing what we can do, seeing how we can be proactive in life. And as Ray Miller concludes this essay, he says, this was the virtue required for the building of the sanctuary and the building of the temple. The spontaneous urge to give, not prompted externally by the needs of the sanctuary or by the sense of shame stemming from the opulence of one's own abode. These were the points of criticism leveled at the princes and at King David. But we need to have Tocho Ratzuf Ahava. Its midst was paved with love. And now we can go back to our original question and see why was it that Ephraim was able to bring the sacrifice on Shabbos. So concludes the Shem Yishmuel, when the prince of Ephraim brought his offering, This was an act of generosity and a shining example of the preference for starting the divine worship of one's tribe with a positive act. Ephraim preceded Manasseh in bringing the sacrifices. And this is indicated by the fact that Elishama brought this offering even though it was Shabbat. The divine wisdom underscored the rationale behind this departure from normative halacha by arranging it that Ephraim and no other tribe was scheduled to bring their offering on Shabbat, because the tribe of Ephraim, more than any other tribe, represented this positive act, this step forward, this tremendous love between themselves and God. And therefore, I think, in summary, that perhaps the theme of the Parsha is the theme of relationship with God, with this model, almost the seesaw model, of Ephraim and Manasseh. On the one aspect, the Parsha, a week after Shavuos, is telling us, in regard to sin, you have the Manasseh aspect, the stealing is the model, removing oneself completely from sin, the aspect of Manasseh. And then you have the aspect of Ephraim, the allegorical level, the next story of the Sota, which is our everlasting and fruitful bond with God, where we come even closer. And then there's a positive aspect, the aspect of holiness, and again you have the continuum. You have the Manasseh aspect, the Nazir who removes himself from physical pleasure, as well as the Ephraim, who's the princess, taking positive initiative, coming close to God, and therefore Ephraim is able, being this model, to give a sacrifice on Shabbos. And the lesson clearly for our lives is being proactive rather than reactive, focusing on the Ephraim, where Yaakov Avinu put his hand on his head first, Ephraim offered the sacrifice first. Life is about focusing on the good. Life is about being proactive. And once we focus in on the good, then we can deal with the Manasseh, the separating from the bad as well. But we first have infused ourselves with the positive, infused ourselves with the good. And through that way, we should also be blessed, like the name of Ephraim, to be Hefrani, to be fruitful, to be multiplied, and to really be productive in our relationship with